Well met, and welcome to episode 105 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for June the 14th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we kick off our two-month-long discussion of Troilus and Cressida with a plot synopsis and a quick intro. As the history of Troilus and Cressida begins, we get a prologue spoken by a man in armor. Instantly, we are taken both by this costuming direction and the opening words, in Troy, to a time of war, the Trojan War. Our choric soldier tells us of the 69 warships sent from the Isles of Greece to ransack Troy. What's the quarrel? To rescue the ravished Helen, Menelaus's queen, who, with wanton Paris, sleeps. We learn of the Trojan siege, but then the prologue states that our play leaps o'er the vaunt and firstlings of those broils, beginning in the middle, starting thence away to what may be digested in a play. The prologue closes on a blatantly ambiguous and seemingly objective note. Like or find fault, do as your pleasures are. Now, good or bad, 'tis but the chance of war. This chorus may be armed, but he doesn't seem to be a partisan on either side. The first scene takes us inside the besieged city of Troy, where we meet two men, a lover, Troilus, and, well, we're not sure what to make of this second man, Pandarus. Troilus calls for his servant boy to help him unarm, stating that there is no need for him to war without the walls of Troy, since he is not the master of his own heart and weaker than a woman's tear. Pandarus wryly responds to Troilus' statements, peppering them with subtly bawdy commentary, discussing Troilus' gear, grinding, bolting, and burnt lips. Quickly enough, we learn why Pandarus is teasing Troilus. Troilus is in love. While he sits at Priam's royal table, we learn Troilus is one of the Trojan king's sons. He pines for fair Cressid, and it becomes obvious that Pandarus has been attempting to bring the prince and his kinswoman together. Gone between and between, but small thanks for my labor. With her father's departure to the Greeks, Pandarus tires of his own meddling in the matter. So tired, in fact, that he leaves Troilus. Alone, Troilus bemoans his state, depending on the tetchy Pandarus for access to the stubborn and haste Cressida. But he isn't alone for long. Trojan commander Aeneas arrives to ask why Troilus isn't in the field and to deliver the news that Paris has returned to Troy injured in battle by Menelaus. Troilus jokes that the injury is a goring with Menelaus's horn, a sarcastic statement of Paris's cuckolding of Menelaus, and within moments, Troilus leaves with Aeneas to head to the field of battle. Now, the second scene takes us to the other side of the love equation, Cressida, who speaks with her servant Alexander. Obviously, we're in the middle of some excitement as Cressida immediately asks who has just gone by. The answer? Hecuba, queen of Troy, and her kidnapped daughter-in-law, Helen, heading off to see the battle. We also hear of the wrath of Hector, Troilus' older brother, caused by Ajax, who had defeated Hector on the battlefield a day earlier. Within moments, Pandarus enters, and we learn that he is Cressida's uncle. Uncle and niece talk of Hector, and Pandarus begins to expound on how Troilus is the better man of the two, and we see more of his trying to bring the prince and his niece together. There's much playful banter, including some body from both sides, like uncle, like niece, comparing the two Trojan princes. In fact, the seeming matchmaking goes so far as to have Pandarus trying to stoke Cressida's jealousy by saying how much more Helen loves Troilus better than Paris, which only prompts a nationalistic insult from Cressida. Then she's a merry Greek indeed. A military retreat is sounded, and we see the warriors return from battle, with Pandarus providing expository and comically comparative descriptions of the men, all while anticipating and talking up the entrance of Troilus. When the young prince finally enters, Pandarus is so exuberant and extreme in his praise that Cressida has to quiet him. Peace, for shame, peace! We also get a distinct view of the class system at work when the common soldiers enter, only to be described as Pandarus as asses, fools, dolts, Chaffin bran, porridge after meat. When Troilus's servant boy calls for Pandarus to come and speak with the prince, Pandarus tells his niece that he'll return soon enough with a token from Troilus, to which Cressida can only say that by the same token, Pandarus is a bawd, witty and slightly bawdy. But I've got to wonder, is the Pandarus name a conscious choice by Shakespeare to link him to the concept of a bawd or pander? Something to explore later. Once alone, Cressida admits in soliloquy of her own attraction to Troilus. More in Troilus thousandfold I see than in the glass of Pander's praise may be. But she knows the power of playing hard to get. Women are angels wooing. Men prize the thing ungained more than it is. And with that bit of wisdom, Cressida exits and the scene ends. As Troilus and Cressida is a love story set during the Trojan War, Act 1, Scene 3 takes us from the lovers to the military headquarters of the Greek army, with Supreme Commander Agamemnon addressing the other commanders. The war, he says, is not going as well as hoped. After 7 years' siege, Troy walls stand. We get some when the going gets tough, the tough get going posturing by Ulysses and the aged advisor Nestor. But even Ulysses has to admit, Troy in our weakness stands, not in her strength. When Agamemnon asks Ulysses what the remedy is, the answer is simple. The absence of Achilles, who is not currently fighting, is hurting the Greek war effort. Once this subject is broached, Nestor continues the finger-pointing, this time at Ajax, keeping to his tent as well, but also Thersites, a slave whose gall goins slanders like mints to weaken and discredit our exposure. Before Agamemnon can respond or offer a solution, a trumpet sounds, and the Trojan general Aeneas arrives with a message for Agamemnon. There's some more posturing and much third-person self-referencing by both before the Trojan delivers his message. Prince Hector is willing to challenge any Greek to single combat. Now, before we begin to think, cool, war is about to be solved, Aeneas reveals that this is less about the macro conflict of the Trojan War than a micro battle over the worth of their respected ladies. If there be one amongst the fairest of Greece that loves his mistress more than in confession when truant vows to her own lips he loves, and dare avow her beauty and her worth in other arms than hers, to him this challenge. Hector, in view of Trojans and of Greeks, shall make it good, or do his best to do it. If none, he'll say in Troy, when he retires, the Grecian dames are sunburnt, and not worth a splinter of a lance, even so much. Well, oh snap. So, instead of arousing mano-a-mano to alter the course of history and the enslavement of entire city-states, we get a proposed throwdown in the name of courtly love. Never mind that courtly love is an anachronism. It won't come into being until medieval Europe, roughly 2,000 years after the events of this play. Message delivered and challenge received, Aeneas exits with Agamemnon and some of the other Greek commanders, leaving only Nestor and Ulysses to debrief over the events. They perceive that though the challenge is spread in general name, it relates in purpose only to Achilles. This provocation may just be what it takes to get Achilles out of his tent and back onto the battlefield. And yet, as the two plot to get Achilles back in the fight, Ulysses has an even greater plan, but he needs the aged advisor's help. He tells Nestor, "Do not consent that ever Hector and Achilles meet. No, make a lottery. And by device, let blockish Ajax draw the sort to fight with Hector. If the dull, brainless Ajax comes safe off, we'll dress him up in voices. If he fail, yet go we under our opinion still that we have better men. But hit or miss, our project's life this shape of sense assumes. Ajax, employed, plucks down Achilles' plumes." It appears by the end of this first act that the love story is filled with teasing and raunchy undertones, and the war story is filled with cynical backbiting. A romance that seems unchaste, and an epic that feels less than heroic. Might the oft-derided genre name problem play fit this play like a glove? We shall see. As Act 2 begins, we meet one of the targets of Nestor and Ulysses' plot, Ajax. Ajax is calling after and beating another Greek, Scurrilus, according to the names of the actors, Thersites. Ajax, who appears to be illiterate on top of being, at least according to Cressid in the previous act, dull and brainless, needs Thersites to learn him the proclamation. As Ajax is quick to strike Thersites, we don't get a clear idea of what that proclamation is at this point, but it would make sense for it to be Hector's challenge. In the midst of the quasi-comic slapstick, think Taming of the Shrews Petruchio and his servant Grumio, Achilles and Patroclus enter, with verbal play commenting upon the physical play. Think of Hortensio questioning the beating Petruchio was giving Grumio. When Thersites continues to insult Ajax, Achilles uses the class system to reprimand the smart aleck Greek. Your last service was sufferance. 'Twas not voluntary. No man is beaten voluntary. Ajax was here the voluntary, and you as under an impress. When Patroclus tells Thersites to be quiet, we get a very interesting retort from him. I will hold my peace when Achilles' brach bids me, shall I? In Shakespeare's day, brach was a term of abuse meaning bitch, which in turn not only meant dog when applied to a man, but also a lewd or sensual woman. In various names of the actors, Patroclus is referred to as Achilles' companion or Achilles' favorite. With that insult, Thersites leaves the scene, which ends with Achilles filling in the blanks from earlier in the scene. Hector's challenge is indeed the proclamation. In Act 2, Scene 2, we're back inside the walls of Troy, with Priam meeting with his sons to discuss an offer made by Nestor. If the Trojans just give back Helen, then the war will be over. Hector, after some qualifying statements, says, let Helen go, supporting his opinion by discussing all that they've lost for just one woman. Troilus, accusing Hector of comparing the honor of their king to the common ounces of the general soldier, but giving no reason else, argues for keeping her. Helenus, the priest, notes Troilus's lack of reasons, and Troilus tries to respond, but his argument is passionate, though muddied. Before anyone else can respond, however, their mad sister, Cassandra, enters with prophetic tears and a warning that Paris burns us all. Troy burns, or else let Helen go. Hector tries to use Cassandra to support his claim to Troilus, but the younger brother discounts her brain-sick raptures. Paris, there all along, finally speaks, declaring that he, in third person no less, will not retract what he has done. Priam rebukes him, saying that while Paris may still have the honey of his act, his brothers have the gall of it. Hector then makes the most cogent argument of all, discussing how nature craves all dues rendered to their owners. And gee, since I know that Troilus and Cressida, after they are brought together, are torn asunder, this would seem to be a little foreshadowing. And while wrong extenuates not wrong, Hector inexplicably says that he will allow his brother to keep Helen. The third and final scene of Act 2 takes us back to the Greek camp, where we find Thersites soliloquizing on being beaten by Ajax, but quickly turning his attention to Achilles, whom he derides as well. Patroclus enters and calls for the surly Greek to come in and rail. When Achilles arrives a few lines later, there's some biting banter as Thersites explains how all are fools in the Greek camp. Agamemnon is a fool to offer to command Achilles. Achilles is a fool to be commanded of Agamemnon. Thersites is a fool to serve such a fool. And this Patroclus is a fool positive. When the Greek commanders come into view, Achilles takes Thersites into his tent, wanting to speak with nobody. Agamemnon sends Patroclus to get Achilles, but he returns quickly with a refusal. Agamemnon does not take it well, saying Achilles is overproud and under-honest, and sends Patroclus back again, and this time has Ulysses go as well. Within a couple of dozen lines, Ulysses is back with another refusal. And when Agamemnon calls for the brute Ajax to go in and get Achilles, Ulysses argues against it. As Ajax talks about how he'll convince Achilles with his armed fist, the others, save for Agamemnon, deride Ajax in asides. When Ajax is done talking, the others speak to Agamemnon, convincing him to go into battle without Achilles. And with the battle looming tomorrow, Act 2 ends. As Act 3 begins, we're back in Troy with Pandarus attempting to see Paris so that he can ask the prince to make an excuse for Troilus when Troilus doesn't attend dinner that night, as Pandarus is hoping to bring Troilus and Cressida together. But first he needs to get past Paris's servant, a comic fool. The interplay feels a bit like that of Viola and Feste, just replace "Do you live by your tabor? No, I live by the church," with Pandarus. "Do you not follow the young lord Paris?" Servant. "Aye, sir, when he goes before me." After some banter, Paris and Helen arrive, and Pandarus welcomes her as Fair Queen, which seems nice enough, except that it's also a homophone for queen, which meant prostitute. That, in and of itself, might seem a bit of a stretch, but Helen's words makes one wonder. She calls Pandarus Honey Sweet Lord and says that falling in after falling out may make them three, which can mean makeup sex can lead to pregnancy. When speaking to her, the breaks in Pandarus' lines almost give the impression of him having to fight her off physically. And then later in the scene, she seems more than happy to go and unarm our Hector after he returns from the field. She doesn't exactly seem to be the picture of chaste suffering for her Greek husband. Act 3, Scene 2 takes us to Pandarus's garden, where Pandarus asks Troilus' servant boy if the prince has already been at Cressida's house. He hasn't. He's waiting for Pandarus to take him. By his own admission, Troilus has been stalking about her door, but has been too afraid to go in. Pandarus tells him to wait and leaves to bring Cressida to him. While Pandarus is gone, Troilus soliloquizes, and it sounds nothing more than like Juliet's soliloquy as she waits for nighttime and her Romeo to come. Giddy, expectation, imaginary relish. It's not all fun and games, though, because there's a little bit of Romeo's post-Mercutio Queen Mab speech as well. Death, I fear me. When Pandarus returns with Cressida, what follows is some of the strangest play-by-play this side of dodgeball. For 14 lines, the two lovers don't say a word, and Pandarus takes over. Don't get excited, this is not a sonnet. Rather, it's a prose description of what the lovers are doing and thinking, as well as some instructions for them. It's a little weird and worthy of deeper discussion later in the months to follow. Troilus' first line following Pandarus' commentary makes some, albeit lame, excuse. You have bereft me of all words, lady. Nice catch, Willie. Pandarus leaves the lovers alone, and we listen as they verbally feel each other out, unsure and anxious, but anticipating love as well. There's a little Romeo and Juliet orchard scene, not to mention a bit of As You Like It's love lessons between Orlando and Rosalind / Ganymede. Troilus speaks words of love. Cressida is a little more reserved. What's interesting here, though, is unlike the other two scenes, this is in prose, and frankly, mostly prosaic. It's only after Pandarus' re-entry to the scene to bodily and kind of bodily bring the two together that they begin to speak verse. Cressida still plays, at least somewhat verbally, hard to get, to the point where even she must admit, I show more craft than love. She fears the position that her gender creates for her, to not be able to lead the conversation. And rightfully so, since at the beginning of the scene, Troilus is so bereft of language. By the end of the scene, though, the two are swearing their love, Troilus to be true, Cressida not to be false. Pandarus proclaims a bargain and says that if either proves false to the other, let the future goes between be called to the world's end after my name. Call them panders. Since we know a word for pimp to be pander, we should not have a good feeling about where this is going. The next scene takes us back to the Greek command, where a priest with prophetic sight who has abandoned Troy is asking for recompense. The Greeks have captured one of the Trojan commanders, Antenor, and this priest, Calchas, is asking that a right great exchange for his daughter. And who's his daughter? You guessed it, Cressida. Agamemnon agrees and orders Diomedes to both make the exchange and return word if Hector has agreed to a fight with Ajax, who is ready to meet in single combat courtly love match. When Diomedes leaves, the commanders notice Achilles and Patroclus standing in their own tent. The commanders decide to walk by him while putting on a form of strangeness as they pass. They all pass by him, pretty much ignoring him, as Ulysses lingers behind, reading. Their plan works. Achilles is left to wonder, what means these fellows? Know they not Achilles? He's confused and a little bit hurt that they didn't give him such rich beholding as they have often given. Achilles questions Ulysses about what is going on, and Ulysses answers that no man is the lord of anything, and that the command has found a new champion in Ajax. Heavens, what a man is there, Ulysses interjects, a very horse. He describes how the Greeks now clap him on the shoulder as if his foot were on brave Hector's breast. When Achilles asks, what are my deeds forgot? Ulysses takes great pains, in nearly 45 lines, to tell him, that all the Greeks begin to worship Ajax, since things in motion sooner catch the eye than what stirs not. The cry went once on thee, and it still it might, and yet it may again, if thou wouldst not entomb thyself alive and case thy reputation in thy tent. Ulysses leaves, and Patroclus takes the blame for making Achilles seem an effeminate man. And as the Greek commanders think Patroclus's little stomach to the war, and Achilles' great love to Patroclus restrains Achilles thus, he then calls upon Achilles to re-enter the fray. Achilles, his reputation at stake, decides to have the fool Thersites take a message to Ajax to bring the commanders back to his tent after the combat. As luck would have it, Thersites happens by. After listening to Thersites describe the egomaniacal Ajax, Achilles calls for Patroclus to go to the beast Ajax and have him instead invite Hector to his tent with safe conduct, etc. And with that, and some more grumbling over Ajax by Thersites, think of that as our, etc., this scene and act of Troilus and Cressida is done. We enter Act 4 with the captured Trojan commander Antenor being brought back to Troy in an exchange for Cressida by the Greek Diomedes, and is greeted by Aeneas and Paris. There is much mutual admiration society talk during this gentle truce, with each wishing the other well, until, of course, they get back on the battlefield, where they will play the hunter for thy life, and with all my force, pursuit, and policy. Paris knows why the visitors have arrived, and he sends Aeneas to Calchas's house, where Cressida is, and where Paris suspects Troilus lodges tonight, to give his brother some warning of their approach, as it shall be much unwelcome. Alone, Paris asks Diomedes, who deserves Helen more, Paris or Menelaus? Diomedes' response is shocking in its bluntness. They both deserve her, but not in a good way, since she is full of soilure, dishonor, false drops in her body veins, contaminated carrion weight. Act 4, Scene 2 takes us to Calchas' house, where we find Troilus and Cressida post-consummation, we can assume, as Cressida asks, are you aweary of me? Pandarus returns to check on their maidenheads, or virginities, and a little body banter begins, only to be interrupted by the knocking on the door, the arrival of Aeneas. Cressida hides, and then Aeneas explains the situation to Troilus, who, stunned, can only ask, is it concluded so? When he learns it is true, he runs off to meet Paris and Diomedes before they can get to Cressida. With Troilus gone, Cressida gets the news from Pandarus, and she's distraught, claiming that being sent away from Troilus will make her the very crown of falsehood, and declaring that she will not leave Troy. In just 12 lines, Act 4, Scene 3 gives us Troilus' arrival with Paris, Antenor, and Diomedes back at Calchas' house. Obvious that Troilus has been given the news by the proverbial horse's mouth this time, and he leaves to bring Cressida out to Diomedes. Immediately, at the beginning of the next scene, we find Pandarus urging Cressida to be calm, but to no avail. Troilus arrives, and the lovers have time for only a single famished kiss, distaste with the salt of broken tears, before they will be separated. Troilus pleads for Cressida to be true of heart. This does not go over well. Cressida is insulted by this wicked deem or supposition, but she relents. Troilus gives Cressida his sleeve as a love token. In return, she gives him her glove. When she asks when they will see each other again, he says that he will nightly bribe the Greek guards so he can see her, but she must be true. If this plea didn't go over well the first time, this demand goes even less well now. This time, though, Troilus explains, the Greeks, full of quality, swelling o'er with arts and exercise, make him afraid of his own inadequacies. As they are about to be interrupted by the entrance of Aeneas, Paris, and Diomedes, she asks him the same question he asked her. His response is that he is but plain and true, but we'll never know her thoughts on the matter, as she doesn't speak for the rest of the scene. The prisoner exchange party arrives, and Diomedes' first words to Cressida seem to justify Troilus' fears. The luster in your eye, heaven in your cheek, pleads your fair usage, and to Diomed, you shall be mistress and command him wholly. Troilus finds this disrespectful to him, but Diomedes doesn't care. To her own worth, she shall be prized. But that you say be it so, I speak in my spirit and honor, no. And the scene ends with their departure. Now, if the previous scene ends with her departure from Troy, Act 4, Scene 5 gives us her arrival at the Greek camp. And there she has to run a gauntlet of kisses by the commanders. Agamemnon, Nestor, Achilles, and Patroclus, twice. Even though she doesn't explicitly kiss in the stage directions, she seems to flirt with Menelaus and Ulysses. It's only Diomedes who seems at all chaste with her. Now, if all of this feels weird, we're not the only ones. Once Diomedes exits, taking Cressida to her father, Nestor and Agamemnon speak of her quick sense and wanton spirits. The Trojan command arrives, and after some preliminaries, the single combat between Ajax and Hector begins and ends, pretty much inconclusively. Ajax and Hector exchange pleasantries, formal flowery compliments, and so begins a post-combat parley that is unusual to say the least. Purple pleasantries that slowly turn to intricate verse trash talk, to barely disguised contempt between Hector and Achilles, which escalates to challenges and acceptances for combat and killing the next day. For now, however, it's time for eating and drinking and revelry, unusual to say the least, like I said. Meanwhile, Ulysses, not knowing Troilus's past with Cressida, takes the prince to Calchas, who is feasting with Diomedes and Menelaus in the latter's tent, where Diomedes gives all gaze and bent of amorous view on the fair Cressid. When Ulysses asks if anyone back in Troy loves Cressida, Troilus can only admit, she was beloved, she loved, she is, and doth. And as the fourth act ends, Ulysses takes Troilus to Menelaus's tent. As Act 5 begins, how many out there thinks this is going to turn out okay? Hands? Anyone? No one. Yeah, I think you're probably right. But before we can get to that, we're back to Achilles and Patroclus, as the former readies for tomorrow's battle with Hector by heating Hector's blood with Greekish wine tonight. Thersites arrives to deliver a note, and as Achilles goes silent reading it, we get more of the insult wars between Achilles' male varlet, or male whore in Thersites' words, and the whoreson indistinguishable cur. When Achilles speaks next, not only do we find out who sent the note, but also a reason why Achilles has been sitting out this portion of the Trojan War. Here is a letter from Queen Hecuba, a token from her daughter, my fair love, both taxing me, engaging me to keep an oath that I have sworn. I will not break it. So he had made a promise before the war not to enter it, that among other reasons, but more on that later in the discussions in the blog. Achilles and Patroclus exit to their tent, and Thersites rails on the folly of the Greeks. And then the Greek commanders show up, seemingly lost, looking for the tent in the dark. Troilus and Ulysses stealthily follow the commanders. Achilles welcomes them all, including Diomedes, who declines, stating that he has important business. When he exits, he's followed by Troilus and Ulysses. When they have all left, leaving Thersites alone, his words do not bode well for Troilus. That same Diomed's a false-hearted rogue, a most unjust knave. I will no more trust him when he leers than I will a serpent when he hisses. They say he keeps a Trojan drab and uses the traitor Calchas's tent. Of course, the Trojan whore, drab, is Cressida, and Calchas's tent is where we head now for Act 5, Scene 2. We, Troilus and Ulysses and Thersites, watch as Diomedes arrives at the tent, is greeted by Cressida with, my sweet guardian, and a whisper in his ear. Troilus wonders how she can be so familiar with Diomedes. Ulysses, remember he of the non-kiss recipient, but witness to much kissing, but then he was recipient to the flirty welcome, he tells Troilus, and remember Ulysses has no idea of the connection between the two, that she will sing any man at first sight. We hear some snippets of the conversation between Cressida and Diomedes, and they could be harmless, but they could also be interpreted more romantically, with discussions of minds coupled with your words, sweet honey Greeks, and mine oath. Troilus reacts to them darkly, and Ulysses tries to get him to leave before his displeasure should enlarge itself to wrathful terms. Troilus doesn't listen, and is thus witness to her stroking his cheek, and worse, her giving Diomedes a token for the surety of some promise she had given him, and that token is the sleeve Troilus had given her on their separation. And yes, she attempts to take it back later, but the damage is done. And when Diomedes leaves her, she speaks what she thinks is in private, but overheard by Troilus, saying that while she still thinks upon Troilus, her heart is ruled by the eye that sees Diomedes here. Before Aeneas can arrive and take Troilus back to Troy, Troilus admits to Ulysses that he was her love in Troy and swears to take on Diomedes in the field tomorrow. Once Ulysses exits to take the Trojans back to the gate, Thersites mocks Diomedes. But before we can begin to like Thersites, he also says that Patroclus will give him anything for the intelligence of this whore, and he leaves to do so. Why? I can think of no reason other than everybody in this play is a total tool. Act 5, Scene 3 takes us back to the king's palace in Troy, where Hector prepares to leave for battle. Andromache, his wife, attempts to keep him home with the same rationale Calpurnia used to try to keep Caesar at home on the Ides of March. Dreams. Cassandra, his sister and a prophetess, arrives to warn him against the battle too. He refuses, citing honor far more precious dear than life. When Troilus enters, armed and ready for the fight, however, Hector's tone changes and he tries to convince his little brother to tempt not yet the brushes of the war. Even their father, King Priam, arrives to convince them to stay, but to no avail. The women are sent off and Priam walks Hector to the gate. Meanwhile, Pandarus brings a note to Troilus from Cressida. He reads it, but finds it to be only words, words, mere words, no matter from the heart, and he tears the letter and leaves for battle. Act 5, Scene 4 takes us to the battlefield, where Thersites provides sarcastic commentary on the skirmishes he sees. It's not as ridiculous as Pandarus's narration of the union of Troilus and Cressida, but funny nevertheless, especially when Thersites describes what he wants to see. I would fain see them meet, that same Trojan ass that loves the whore there might send that Greekish whore-master villain with the sleeve back to the dissembling luxurious drab of a sleeveless errand. And he gets his wish. Troilus chases Diomedes onto the stage and then tells him to stop running away. Diomedes' response is pure and wonderful and total BS. I do not fly, but advantageous care withdrew me from the odds of multitude. Falstaff couldn't have said it better about his discretion. They then begin to fight and continue to fight as they exit from the stage. Hector rushes Thersites and wants to know if he's a Greek and wants to fight. The fool admits to being nothing more than a rascal, a scurvy, railing knave. Hector believes and leaves him to live, which he does by running off stage in the opposite direction. Scene 5 takes us to another part of the battlefield where we find that Diomedes has escaped from his fight with Troilus with his life. But for Troilus, his fate is uncertain, but Diomedes wants his own servant to take Troilus's horse and present the fair steed to my lady Cressid and tell her Diomedes has won. Agamemnon enters to tell Diomedes that things are going not so well for the Trojans, and we're about to find out just how not so well. Nestor enters carrying the body of Patroclus, slain by Hector, of whom there seems to be 1,000, and what he will he does, and does so much that proof is called impossibility. We also learn that Troilus hath done today mad and fantastic execution, and we must wonder if he's still alive, and thus Diomedes lying. If there's any good news, Ulysses brings it. Great Achilles is arming, weeping, cursing, vowing vengeance. Patroclus's wounds have roused his drowsy blood. And within lines, Achilles enters, wanting revenge on Hector. Act 5, Scene 6 takes us to another part of the battlefield, where Ajax and then Diomedes call out for Troilus, who arrives to challenge Diomedes again. And they exit fighting. Again, Hector arrives, but then so does Achilles, and they begin to fight. But then something happens. We're not sure from the stage directions, but Hector offers the opportunity to pause. And Achilles wants to disdain Hector's courtesy, but he needs the rest. And he exits. Troilus enters with news that Ajax has taken Aeneas, and then exits to find another fight, while Hector chases another Greek away. But before we can get a chance to think Hector heroic, however, he says he's chasing the Greek to steal from him, as Hector likes his armor well. The next short scene finds Achilles with his Myrmidon troops, telling them to impale Hector with their weapons round about. In scene 8, Hector drags onto the stage his Greek victim. Tired, he begins to take off some of his armor, as his day's work is done, and he can rest. Once unarmed, Achilles and his troops enter, and Achilles tells Hector that his life is done. Hector points out his own unarmed state and calls for Achilles to forego this advantage, as he had allowed Achilles to pause and flee. Instead of the honorable payback, Achilles calls for his men to strike Hector down, and they do, and then cry, "You all a man, Achilles hath the mighty Hector slain," which he really didn't. He has them then tie Hector's body to his horse so he can drag the corpse around. News of Hector's death reaches the Greek commanders in the nine-line scene nine, which ends with their prediction that this will lead to their victory over the Trojans. And in the act's tenth and final scene, and the last one of the play, the same death news reaches the Trojan camp, and Troilus too seems to see the end of their war because of it. The other Trojans leave, and when Pandarus attempts to speak to Troilus, the prince dismisses him. "Hence, broker, lackey, ignominy and shame, pursue thy life, and levy with thy name." Pandarus is left by Troilus on stage, only a pander now. Pandarus then addresses the audience in the last speech of the play. He admits that he is despised now, and wonders if we, can weep for him, especially now that he fears that he will die of diseases of his hold-door trade, his pandering and pimping. Regardless, he closes, he will leave all of his diseases to us. And thus ends the play. So, I'm one read into the play, partway through a second, and what are my initial responses? This is a strange play. I mean, what is it? How do you categorize it? History? Despite its quarto title, not so much. Tragedy? It was listed as one in the first folio, but I don't know. If so, who's your tragic hero? How about a comedy? Not even in a bizarro universe where Love's Labor's Lost is one without the usual show-ending wedding. Tragicomedy? No way. Dark comedy? Maybe, I guess. I know, many of you don't like that moniker, problem play. But this is the most problematic of the plays I've read thus far. I certainly didn't enjoy it on a first go. In fact, I flirted with the idea of making this a one-month play. I've certainly seen a precipitous drop in page views on the blog since this month started. Of course, that might be because the school year is ending and much of my target audience is heading off to vacation. But there does seem to be some stuff to write about in this play. It kind of feels like a Vitamix play, you know, part love story, though not a romantic one, part war story, though definitely not a heroic one. And the tone? I'll know more after another read, but it feels cynical, maybe even a bit misogynistic. And it doesn't feel like Shakespeare to me. Even when I was put off by the Two Gentlemen of Verona and bored by King John, at least those were Shakespeare to me, but this one? It's just strange. If nothing else, it should make for an interesting month and a half to come, even if the blog entries aren't completely engrossing. But I hope you stick around for it. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries the last couple of weeks, you've missed out on subjects including a new month, a new play, Troilus and Cressida, Speaker Bureau site launches, Act 1 plot synopsis, Homer, not Simpson, Act 2 plot synopsis, Boccaccio and Chaucer 2, Act 3 plot synopsis, Act 4 plot synopsis, Not Your Homer's Iliad, Act 5 plot synopsis, and Happy Birthday, Kyle. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page or our Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. Join us again in 2 weeks for our next podcast when we continue our discussion of Troilus and Cressida. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for June the 14th, 2015. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.